I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Europe is experiencing a series of political upheavals, and it's not clear how it's all going to end. British Prime Minister Theresa May is still trying to figure out how to keep her job and how her country is going to leave the European Union as the Brexit deadline looms just a couple of months away. Yellow-vested protesters took to the streets of Paris to criticize a rise in the cost of diesel fuel, sparking riots that revealed a deep rural-urban divide in the country and exposed the weakness and unpopularity of President Emmanuel Macron. German Chancellor Angela Merkel announced that she would be stepping down in 2021 when her term ends and has been replaced as leader of her party, the Christian Democratic Union. And to add to the turmoil, populism is growing in Hungary, Poland, Italy, while Russia continues to throw its weight around and the U.S. distances itself from its European allies and is pulling all of its troops out of Syria at the direction of President Trump in a tweet that surprised everyone. Well, here to talk about all of this is Mauro Guillen. He's a professor of international management, director of the Lauder Institute at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, author of Rude Awakening, Threats to the Global Liberal Order. Mauro Guillen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And joining us from Europe is Judy Dempsey. She's a non-resident senior fellow at Carnegie Europe, editor-in-chief of Strategic Europe. And Judy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. Judy, let me begin with you. Something that you wrote recently, that the crises that we are seeing in a number of European countries have several things in common that are really changing the relationship between leaders and citizens. What are these things that you observed?
I think there's a growing disillusionment with the political elites in most of the European countries. And I think it's because the nature of politics has changed, and the nature of politics has become much more complex, largely because of the growing influence of social media. And in some ways, the leading politicians haven't got a handle on social media. They're a bit out of sync. They're behind. So they have to communicate what they really want, how they're going to do it. But this essentially means doing town hall meetings and getting out and doing a lot of footwork. I think that's the first thing. And secondly, there's very high youth unemployment across Europe. This seriously has to be tackled and very, very soon. And all these things seem to be coming together. It's not going to fall apart, the EU, but it's pretty fragile at the moment.
What do you see, Mauro? And you just got back from visiting a couple of cities in Europe. What do you see? And a couple of other things that Judy mentioned in her piece was the effect of globalization. I think that's affecting everyone in the world, and also migration.
Absolutely. And that is, I think, the topic that is at the top of the agenda in many parts of Europe right now. And I would add to the list that Judy mentioned the disarray within the traditional political parties. So it's not just the political establishment, but it's the political parties themselves in several of these countries, notably in France, in Italy, also to a certain extent in Germany on the part of the Social Democrats. The traditional parties that were so strong throughout the post-World War II period are now barely getting any votes in surveys, right? And that they may be wiped out from national parliaments.
Are we seeing Europe falling apart, Mauro?
Well, I wouldn't say falling apart, but certainly the challenges are many. And I think the future doesn't look as promising as one would want it to be.
Judy, I'm curious about what we also see as the rise of nationalism or populism. Is that replacing, I guess, the void that both you and Mauro are describing?
It depends on the country and what this issue is at the center. Can the center hold in some of the big EU countries? And interestingly, it's still holding in Germany because Chancellor Angela Merkel has moved her party to the center. Yes, they've lost votes to the anti-immigrant and Eurosceptic alternative for Germany. But nevertheless, the Greens and the Christian Democrats hold the centre, and this is very important. The centre is sort of holding in France. It's sort of holding in the Netherlands. It's very fragile in Italy. It's very fragile in Austria. And let's not even talk about Britain and Brexit because it's so polarised.
Oh, well, we will be talking about that. But no, go ahead, Judy.
Yes, I'm sure. But one thing that that was brought up, you see, the migration issue, it slowed down, but the populace, because they don't come up with options, come up with ideas, come up with scenarios, they latch onto certain things, whether it's fake news or whether it's migration, to put their point across. And in some ways, the political parties, the main established political parties, haven't challenged them on this. Some of them have moved over to the populace in order to take the wind out of their sails. Whereas if you feel competent, if the EU feels that it's competent in all the things that it's done over the past 40 years, they should stand up and say, this is our achievements and this is where we're going.
Mauro, can the centre hold?
Well, that's the only hope, I think. The problem is that in some of these countries, the far left or the extreme right have essentially started to dominate the debate. And they are sending very clear messages, very simple and simplified messages to the population, to the effect of if we are in government, then the jobs will return. Mm-hmm. Or if we're in government, we're going to solve the immigration issue. Or if we're in government, then, healthcare and everything will be better.
Lots of
right?
promises, right?
Exactly. Promises that are populist in nature in the sense that they appeal to the basic needs of the population, but at the same time would be very difficult to implement in the way in which they are being presented. But once again, through the use of social media, as Judy mentioned, and other means, these parties are now gaining a lot of attention. And it's very difficult, actually, with a more sophisticated, more realistic argument to counter that simplified, oversimplified message. It's very, very difficult for the center to hold.
But it sounds like what we're hearing, and obviously it varies from country to country, is that there are large swaths of people, probably middle class or maybe working class, that feel, Mauro, as if their leaders are not delivering to them what it is that they say they need.
Correct, because both on both sides of North Atlantic, here in the United States and in Europe, the middle class has been stagnant. And that this is very much unlike what happened to the previous two generations of the middle class in Europe and the United States, where parents would expect their sons and daughters to do better than themselves. And this is no longer happening. Mm-hmm. And we have this duality whereby highly educated people are doing great because globalization helps them. But then those who, for whatever reason, they don't do well at school and they don't have, training or skills, then they fall behind. And this is creating a two-speed society. On top of that, you have then the immigration problem, right? And again, immigration is not a monolithic phenomenon because you have a lot of immigrants that are very highly educated and they
sure.
do very well.
Sure.
And at the same time, you have other immigrants that don't do that well and they live in ghettos, and they, according to some of these parties, they create a lot of problems. So the whole thing is becoming very difficult to deal with, obviously.
Judy, let me go back to you, and let's indeed talk about Brexit. We must, because it's certainly in the news. And Theresa May is trying, I guess, to figure out how to make this Brexit thing work. Mm-hmm. She's got opposition in her own country. It also was recently in Brussels. There's opposition there. Where do you see this going? I love that pause. I can't tell you, Judy, how much I love that pause.
I'll tell you, because I was going to say nobody knows, but I have to say something. And this is what's happening right as you speak. The EU Commission, that's the executive, they are leading the negotiations with Theresa May, the British Prime Minister. And they have drawn up a plan for a British crash, that the British will crash out, there will be no Brexit deal. And they have drawn up really important contingency measures because they believe they have to have a plan B. They believe that May cannot deliver on anything. She's totally paralysed back in London. And because of this extraordinary situation that Britain was so unprepared legally and strategically in dealing with the talks to extricate themselves from the EU now has to deal with the day after. Right. And the day after, as we speak today, is about a crash, that the British government will not have a Brexit deal. And this is extremely it's fraught with dangers for Europe, and it's fraught with dangers for Britain, and it's fraught with dangers for Ireland, all at the same time when we have a crisis in the transatlantic relationship.
Maura, let me get you to weigh in on that. And just to say that the deadline is March 29th, 2019. So we're talking about something that is scheduled to happen in a couple of months. What do you see?
Well, that's exactly, I think, what Theresa May's strategy seems to be right now. So her strategy seems to be to run the clock. This is what commentators on the BBC, commentators on The Guardian have been saying, which is that her only strategy right now is to run the clock, put so much pressure on the members of her own party so that they are confronted with a choice between her deal, which half of them don't like,
right,
or no deal, which would be, of course, catastrophic. So I think that's her strategy, or at least according to the observers on the ground in London, right? But it's a very dangerous strategy that could backfire. Now, at the same time, there's another development that just a few days ago there was a European court that ruled that Britain could actually say, well, after all, you know, we're not going to exit, right? So they're leaving the door open, right, to maybe a third possible outcome, which is no Brexit by March 30th of this coming year, so in a little bit more than 3 months from now. So the situation is very volatile. It changes by the minute. But the fundamental problem is that the Conservative Party is not united behind her, you know, their prime minister. And this is a serious problem, obviously, right?
Who in Europe, though, wants the Brexit deal that was voted on? I mean, it was they won not by a lot of votes, but nonetheless voted on. Who was behind that, or who is behind that now?
Well, behind that is the more moderate conservative members of parliament. And the ones opposing it are the ones who would prefer a harder Brexit, not a 100% hard Brexit, okay, but a harder Brexit, a clearer Brexit. And at the core of it is the famous backstop for Northern Ireland. So the idea that at all costs the freedom of movement across the border should be preserved.
Right.
And Britain originally suggested that they would come up with some technology that would enable them to control who was crossing the border, the tracks and everything, without having to stop them, which was the goal. And apparently this is not possible, at least not in the short term. So the backstop measure essentially means that the customs union, meaning free trade and free movement, would continue to be in place. But if that's the case, then the more radical conservative members of parliament say, well, that's like remaining in the EU, so they're not happy about that. So the problem is that the more radical members, they want to have it both ways. They want Britain to, as you said, extricate itself from the European Union right away.
Right.
But at the same time, they don't want to create a big problem in Northern Ireland, right, in Ireland.
Judy, we're almost up on a break here, but just your thoughts to what Moro just said there.
That is so clear. I mean, you should be commenting for the BBC, frankly. I mean, we've 90 days left. Anything can happen. And there won't be another referendum. And even if there is another referendum, it just won't solve the problem. The country is too polarised, and the opposition Labour Party hasn't come out and declared where it stands. This is the great weakness of this whole British malaise, that the opposition party is divided, bitterly divided, and led by a person who won't actually say where he really stands.
Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Judy Dempsey. She's a non-resident senior fellow at Carnegie Europe. She's also editor-in-chief of Strategic Europe. And we have talked to her in the past when we want to talk about what's happening in Europe. Also with us, Moro Guillen. He's a professor of international management, director of the Lauder Institute at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania here in Philadelphia, author of Rude Awakening, Threats to the Global Liberal Order. Someone else we often talk to when we do want to talk about Europe. If you want to talk about Europe, and we hope you do, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Judy Dempsey and Moro Guillen about the political crises that are roiling much of Europe. And again, you can join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And again, calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me shift gears and let's talk about France. There were the riots of recent weeks protesting the increase in diesel fuel. And I just wanted to read a couple of quotes that Thomas Friedman included in his article that was titled The End of Europe? Question mark. He quoted a man named Florence, 55, worked for an air freight company outside of Paris, who said of Macron, when he appears on television, we have the impression he is uncomfortable with normal people, that there is a certain contempt for us. He quoted a man named Bruno, who was from Lyon, a retired carpenter, who said, said, I have a little diesel van and I don't have money to buy a new one, especially as I'm about to retire. We have the feeling those from the countryside are forgotten. And he quoted a woman named Marie. She's 62, a school teacher, who says, I'm here for my children and grandchildren and all those people left crying by the 15th of the month because they're gone. They're gone into the red. Macron is our Louis XVI, and we know what happened to him. He ended up at the guillotine. Let me begin with you, Moreau. I think in this country, people look at Macron and they think, hey, you know, maybe we'd like to have one of those to head up our country. In France, his popularity is about 25%.
Yeah, absolutely. There were high hopes when he was elected. He was a blow of fresh air into the French political system. And people, you know, thought that he might actually be able to push some reforms. And he decided to, implement some really tough measures to make the French economy more competitive. And now we're starting to see the backlash, like has happened to every president in France, since Mitterrand for the last four presidents. They've all tried to reform the economy, the labor market and all of that. And there's always this backlash. And at the end of the day, the problem, I was in Paris just 2 days ago, is that people are saying, look, I mean, the government is asking us to pay more in taxes. The government is asking us to work harder. The government is asking us for do this and do that. At the same time, they're increasing, they're reducing speed limits in highways. That was also a point of contention.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
And they're asking us, not to pollute. And they're asking us to do this and to do that. People are saying we're fed up, right? The politicians are not delivering what we want. So we want alternatives. And that's why right now, if there were a presidential election in France, at least in the first round, remember they have two rounds, the National Front would again be perhaps the most voted party.
And that's Marine
Le Pen.
Which
is crazy. And that's Marine Le Pen.
To you, Judy, I mean, this got sparked by an increase in the cost of diesel fuel.
Yeah.
What do you see going on in France?
From the outset, when you have riots and demonstrations in France, they have a ferocity and a violence that it doesn't compare to any other EU country. This is a very old tradition in France. Bang, they can really go out in the streets and throw stones and everything else. So this is a continuity of a very old French tradition. Look what the French Revolution did. This is the first thing. Secondly, Macron is not the greatest communicator, but France has been living on borrowed time for at least two or three decades. It's budget deficits, the pension system and the outdated pension system, the whole extraordinarily antiquated tax system with all the exemptions, an antiquated labour law which Macron has tried to fix, the school system. And he's tackled it head on for one reason, that if you don't make France competitive and if you don't make France economically strong, France will not wield any political influence in Europe.
Hmm.
One goes with the other, and if without one, there isn't the other. And he's trying to do this. This is the first thing. Secondly, I think the other EU countries are quite hypocritical. They were delighted that Macron saw off the National Front, Marine Le Pen, and particularly Germany. And Angela Merkel owed Macron something in terms of giving him some help in terms of his view of Europe. And neither the northern EU states nor Germany really gave Macron what he needed to push Europe forward. It's very controversial in a more integrated way, financial, monetary and reform of the Eurozone. So while he did produce some very positive results back home, the European leaders didn't give him that extra push he needed. After all, he campaigned on a European platform, and now he hasn't been rewarded by the EU member states. And back home, because of his style, the rural and the lower middle classes have had enough.
Hmm. To you, Maura, I'm picking up on both you and Judy said then. First of all, so are we going to see that famous French safety net begin to fall apart, or perhaps it is falling apart?
Well, not immediately, because you see, Macron has tried to appease the protesters by offering them, higher wages and all sorts of other things. The cost is going to be $10 billion, which is about 0.4% of French GDP, which means that then France will no longer be complying with the 3% budget deficit limit in the Eurozone. And of course, the Germans are not happy about this. And the Italians have, you know, as always, tried to exploit the situation, saying, well, you should also find France. We tried, you know, you tried to find Italy because we weren't complying. So now you should, you know, find France. Every predecessor in the presidency of France has also done the same thing, has essentially thrown money at the protesters. So France is a very conservative society. So the barricades and the protests and all of that give you the impression that it's a very radical society. It's actually a very conservative one, where the status quo is very difficult to change. And essentially then every single president, every single government has had enormous trouble trying to reform the labor market, trying to make the economy more competitive, trying to, you know, essentially bring France into the 21st century. This is the problem there of all of the countries in Europe, in the Eurozone. Over the last 10 years since the crisis began, France has been the one that has implemented the fewer reforms. It's where labor costs have continued to be very high relative to other competitors. And the economy essentially has fallen behind. Unemployment is about 9%, where in Germany is lower than here in the United States. In Germany, it's about 3.3%. So unemployment in France is nearly three times as high as in Germany. That is an indicator, right, of how things are on the ground.
Judy, let me go back to you, and then we've got some folks that want to join join our conversation here. One of the things that you wrote about France is that it's both rich and uncompetitive, and both you and Mauro are describing some pretty serious systemic problems in France. If Macron can't do it because of the protests, where do you see France going?
He will do it.
He will?
Yes. He's young. He's not going to back down. He'll give something over the next couple of weeks or months, and he will go back again. Remember, this is the appalling timetable, the electoral timetable of Europe. There's the European Parliament elections and then choosing a new commission in Brussels. So that, and Macron has to be very careful that he doesn't hand over his lack of popularity, Marine Le Pen and the National Front. But I think he will do it. France has no alternative. It's got to push ahead. It's got to be itself again in Europe, and we're missing this. And France has been dormant as a political force and as a political innovator inside the EU for about 10 or 15 years. And Macron knows this. Europe will go nowhere until France is strong again.
You think that's true, Mauro?
Yes, I agree. I mean, Macron has little to lose. He's going to keep on pushing, no doubt about that. The only problem, of course, is that there are European elections in a few months. And the issue with the European elections is that people use them as an opportunity to voice their anger or their disagreement. And given that there has no immediate consequences in terms of the national politics, only in terms of representation in the European Parliament. And if the French people use that European election to punish Macron and they vote in massive numbers for the National Front, they're going to be sending a very clear signal, which is that they don't believe Macron is the right president, right? Yes and no, right? I mean, there are, I think, very important incentives for Macron to push ahead. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of people who are very unhappy.
Well, he's got to get his numbers up, to hold on to his job, but also to be able to convince the French people that he's got something that will help their lives.
Absolutely.
That's Mauro Guillen. Also with us, Judy Dempsey. We're talking about what's happening in Europe. And I do want to talk about Germany, but let me just first get a couple of comments here. One from Sean, who says, my question is, if Britain crashes out of the EU in March, that is, leaves without a replacement trade deal or border arrangement, what would be the everyday consequences? And it seems that such an event would make life in Britain more difficult. I live in King of Prussia, but actually reside most of the year in northern England now, so this is increasingly a pressing issue for me. Judy, can you respond to that, which is, Brexit is. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you for this. If Britain crashes out, the EU's contingency plans are very short-term. Essentially, if Britain crashes out, a British airline will not be able to fly from Berlin to Milan or Berlin to other EU countries. They will need special permission. And so, the EU is trying to facilitate this kind of quasi-transition period, especially over financial services for British citizens living in Europe. But this is only short term. The long term would be absolutely catastrophic. Britain would be isolated. Forget about trade deals. If there's no deal with the EU, Britain really cannot do its own trade deals with the rest of the world. And as for the Northern Ireland question, what we are really looking at fundamentally is the future sustainability of the peace process, which was done in the Good Friday Agreement. I mean, there's so much at stake.
And so much potential, I guess, crisis at stake, obviously, as well. Thanks for that comment. Let me get Harry from Northeast Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Harry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment was not currently about the current discussion of France, but about Brexit and Central Europe. There's always been a range of political views and fringe parties. The issue in the last few years, what delivered truckloads of votes to those extreme parties? And that issue is immigration. So the people of Europe are a little bit shocked and saying, why do we have this mass population from one country emigrating to another country? So I think it's immigration which has delivered truckloads of votes to these extreme parties.
Harry, I appreciate the call. And let me give Mauro Guillen a chance to respond to that. And that's a good way to segue into talking about Germany. But Mauro, immigration?
Yeah, absolutely. Immigration has been at the core of this movement towards populism in Europe that has been reflected in the polls. It has happened in Italy, it has happened in Austria, in the Netherlands, in Sweden, in Germany, since the refugee crisis, and as well in the UK. I mean, Brexit, to a very large extent, has immigration. Sovereignty, more broadly, right? It's like the loss of control over the borders, both in terms of trade and the movement of people. So the immigration debate lies at the core of everything that we're talking about. The issue, of course, is what do you do about it? Right now you have 1.2 British citizens living in the EU and 2.9 million EU citizens living in Britain. So one thing is to say, yes, we're going to change the rules of engagement here. Britain is going to get out of the European Union. But then another is, what do you do with all of those people who are there? Poland is making a lot of noises because, as you know, there's nearly a million Poles living in the UK, right? So there's all sorts of complications here. And once again, the populist politicians oversimplify the debate. It's not as simple as that. And by the way, British industry is very unhappy about all of this.
Because they need the labor?
They need the labor, especially the qualified labor. Just a week ago, the government, one of the ministers in Theresa May's government said that they were going to limit immigration of highly skilled people and, of course, British industry. Now, this is the Conservative Party, which is supposed to be supporting the interests of British business, right? So everything seems to be upside down, right? But again, the problem is that people are listening to those oversimplified messages about immigration, about borders, about trade, about technology, about jobs that are disappearing. And that is creating a situation magnified by social media, which is very difficult to deal with because it's very difficult to have a rational, calm debate about these issues right now. It's very difficult.
Judy, let me go back to you and let's talk about Angela Merkel. And she did a couple of years ago essentially open Germany to the immigrants that were coming from the Middle East. What was the impact? And does that explain her decision to essentially exit the stage in a couple of years?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. Yes and no. I mean, the refugee issue has been used to its full by the far right here in Germany. But what is very interesting is that last week the head of the German Association for Employers came out and said, "Hey, this was a great thing that Angela Merkel did because we have a huge labor shortage." And guess what? The refugees are being slowly integrated. They are learning German. They are getting jobs. There's a million, but the statistics about 30%, 30 to 40% are now in jobs of some sort, which is staggeringly high, actually, in such a short space of time. But essentially, what's happening in this debate that the populist movements and the far right or the far left, they don't want to acknowledge that we have a serious demographic problem across Europe. And a serious labor shortage. The Hungarian demonstrations across the board were just not about the overtime. They were the fact that there aren't enough Hungarian workers to deal with the huge amount of industry that has been set up in Hungary. There's a labour shortage in Poland. There's a demographic problem across Eastern Europe. There's a demographic problem across Western Europe. And what is the answer? Well, fine, we go down digitization, robotics, forget it, it's not going to happen overnight. We need migrants. We need a coherent, very clear migration policy. And the EU still cannot agree this. And this is a real, real problem. And I'm going to make a guess here that actually Germany is going to make this work.
Ah, interesting. Interesting. What do you see, Mauro? And I'm not sure. I mean, she put the deadline of, I think, 2021 that Angela Merkel will essentially step aside. But how do you see Europe without Angela Merkel as German Chancellor?
Well, Germany will still be there.
Yes, I understand.
They already have in place a leader for the conservative, for the Christian
called
Democratic Union,
right?
Called Mini Merkel, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, who is actually different than Merkel. I think she will be another great leader if elected as chancellor. If she has enough support in parliament to become chancellor. One thing that I think I would like our listeners to know is that German industry has said in the last couple of days that they need over the next few years an additional 1 million workers, and they can't find them in Germany. They cannot find them in Germany. They need immigration. And remember, once again, unemployment in Germany is 3.3%, which is a little bit lower than here in the United States. They're at full employment. The economy is doing really well. It's extremely competitive. They need workers, right? And that they can't find them in Germany because primarily because of population aging. I mean, the younger age cohorts are just too small these days because 20 or 25 years ago, the Germans weren't having enough babies. So immigration has to be part of the equation. The problem or the issue is what kind of immigration policy is best, right? In Europe, not only in Germany, in Europe, in all of Europe.
And how to hold all that stuff together. Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Mauro Guillen, Professor of International Management, Director of the Lauder Institute at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Judy Dempsey with us as well. Joining us from Europe, non-resident senior fellow at Carnegie Europe, Editor-in-Chief of Strategic Europe. And we are talking about Europe on Radio Times today. And you can join our conversation. Any questions or comments? 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We've been talking about Britain and Brexit, France and Germany. And I do want to talk about some other countries in Europe as well. But I do want to get your response from both of you about the fact that the president of the United States, I think, surprised his administration, people that work with him, foreign policy, surprised a lot of the world by saying that the U.S. was pulling its troops out of Syria, that ISIS is defeated, and it's time at least for American troops to go home. Mauro, what do you think the impact of this will be on Europe?
Well, the impact, I think, would be enormous if, in fact, ISIS, according to the experts, is not defeated and it's still a force to be reckoned with. So this could reignite another immigration crisis. So Europe is obviously not happy about this pullout, and in particular France, because France is the European country with the most at stake in Syria, a former colonial power in that part of the world, and has a major presence right now. So I don't know exactly what to make out of this. It seems to be another impulsive thing. Even very hawkish senators from the Republican Party have come out very strongly against this decision, asking the president to reverse himself. I think it is in general yet another problem for Europe in particular. Yeah.
Judy, you're joining us from Berlin. What has been the response to the president? This was a tweet and then an announcement, but what's the response so far?
They're very worried about it because this vacuum will be filled by Russia and it will be filled by Turkey. And what the German establishment cannot understand is that since President Trump is so anti-Iran and Iran plays a huge role in Syria, why is the United States now leaving Syria? And so this is actually very, very worrying. This is the first thing. Secondly, nobody's sure what sort of deal Trump did with Turkey, if he did do a deal. And secondly, and thirdly, the Saudi regime is extremely worried about this as well. Mm-hmm. It's as if President Trump is walking away from what has become really a geostrategic playground. And if the Americans leave, then we have the Saudis in there, we have the Iranians in there, we have the Turks in there, and the Russians. And the Russians will be one of the big key players there, continue to be. It's a very, very strange decision.
Well, let me ask you, Judy, just to follow up, and to you, Mauro, as well. It's been almost 2 years since Donald Trump has been the president, and we know, Judy, that he certainly has criticize members of Europe. He seems to have a true bromance with Vladimir Putin of Russia. What, after 2 years, what is the response of leadership to Donald Trump? And do they feel they can in any way work with him?
It's a question of having to. And the feeling from Berlin, certainly, and from Paris, and let's leave out London and Rome at the moment, is that they have to have some dialogue with him. But they go round him. They talk to the Pentagon, the State Department. They go round to the other states, which are very important, California, wherever you go to, and they try to communicate to the governors there. But it's left Europe very. It's left Europe with a very kind of unpredictability. They know that the transatlantic relationship has changed fundamentally, and even if Trump does leave the political stage whenever, that there is no going back. The post-1945 era is over. We're hell-bent into the 21st century, and we have to deal with this. And the Europeans have been caught on the hop. They've been sleepwalking for such a long time because of the dependence, military security dependence on the United States. And now, finally, there's a debate inside Europe on how do we deal with our own defense. But it's very, very slow, and it's not going to get off the ground. But this issue over Syria has really jolted them, because the question of refugees and migration could actually come to the fore again.
Maury, do you want to respond to that? Let me just throw Russia into the mix. Obviously, Russia on that eastern edge of Europe. How do you see all these pieces either fitting together or falling apart?
Well, I think there are, you know, two ways of thinking about this. The first is what Merkel said a few months ago when she realized that the United States was no longer, at least the Trump administration, willing to collaborate with Europe on all of these issues. She said, we have to take our future in our own hands. And I think that captures it all really, really well, right?
At the same time, is that a bad thing?
I think that's a good thing. So Europe should certainly, I think, be more assertive. But the issue, of course, is that the only country in Europe that is in a position to lead is Germany. And, of course, Germany carries some baggage, right? And Germany doesn't have its own army, in a way that is an army that can be, used in the world for many different kinds of both political and legal reasons. So that is a difficult situation. But another way of thinking about this is yes, in fact, Europe is, just think about its location on the map. It's at the crossroads of everything, right? So it's surrounded by Russia, by the Middle East, by Africa to the south. And then it has now, Britain to the west. And who knows exactly which way Britain is going to go once it leaves the European Union? Is it going to become a closer ally to the United States, or is it going to try to, cement its relationship on an equal footing with the European Union? So Europe is in a very, very delicate situation right now, because all of these pieces, as you mentioned earlier, they are themselves moving in different directions, right? And so Europe is struggling. It's really struggling to see what is the what do we make of all of this? How should we? And at the same time, of course, it's deeply divided.
Sure.
That's the other issue.
Sure, right? Sure. Let me get Dale. Looks like Dale calling us from Landenburg, Pennsylvania. And Dale, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks. These discussions always seem to kind of pretend that refugees and migration just happens out of the ether for no good reason. But I want to just suggest in a common sense way that maybe if we in the U.S. and the Europeans don't stop supporting us bombing countries to smithereens, maybe perhaps people would be rushing across the borders a little less. Just a silly question.
Not a silly question at all, Dale. Judy, do you want to take that? I mean, obviously, refugees are fleeing, you know, misery and suffering in their own countries.
Absolutely, and I'm glad you brought up this question. Bombing, frankly, is not the answer. And some of the key European countries really messed it up big time in Libya. And look how that had a domino effect over a part of the Sahel in that part of Northern Africa. I think the refugee and migration issue is not just even a result of bombing. Yes, we have Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and Syria, and these are unresolved problems still, and the refugees will continue. But what people forget is that there will be huge migration over the coming years because of climate change. Climate change is actually eating into the desertification of the Sahel. The whole area of grasslands has been dried up, and people are just moving across in their tens of thousands to find a livelihood. And the Europeans have to really deal with this. So we have two elements. Does war get rid of dictatorship? And if war does, well, what about the day after building up a society and stability? And then we have the other issue of the huge dramatic effects of climate change.
Well, that's so interesting, and I think connects some of the things we've been talking about, because, Mauro, one of the things that Macron did in France was to increase the cost of diesel fuel in a sense to deal with the problem of fossil fuels and climate change. Can you weigh in on that at all?
Well, yes, exactly. Everything is interconnected.
It is interconnected.
And I don't want to make things even more complex, but when we think about Africa and migration from Africa, Southern Africa, making it all the way to the north, and this is also a source of concern in Europe, the only country that is really on the ground in Africa with a clear strategy, serving, of course, its own purposes, is China, right? So Europe and the United States, for the most part, right, the governments are not doing enough in sub-Saharan Africa to help those countries develop and to absorb the rapid population growth. They're creating jobs over there. The NGOs are doing, American and European NGOs are doing a great job, but not the governments themselves. By a
and
wide
the governments
margin,
are the ones that get the credit, I
exactly,
guess.
Exactly. By a wide margin, the Chinese government is doing so much more in sub-Saharan Africa. So there's a disconnect there as well, right?
Judy, let me go back. I was in Germany a couple of years ago, and one of the things that was just so visible were the windmills all over the country. Is Germany still going to sort of lead the charge when it comes to reducing greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, they're still burning brown coal, for heaven's sake, and fossil fuels. I mean, when Angela Merkel introduced, abolished all nuclear power by 2021, she didn't put in place a strategic policy to speed up the whole integration of the renewable network, such as being able to save energy and connect the north to the south. I mean, it's history. It'll happen, but it's much slower than expected. But I just want to pick up, Mervyn, on that the governments aren't doing anything in Africa. I think something interesting is happening between Europe and Africa. And it's this new... First of all, we mustn't... the African governments and the civil societies are coming up. They realize what China is doing without conditions, that China will own them or not empower them. On the other hand, the Europeans have woken up to this, and they're reaching out more and more with the African Union in terms of development aid, bottom up instead of top down. And it's very, very slow, and it won't happen overnight, but there's increasing awareness that the Europeans and Africans have to work much more closely together, and that the African people have to own what happens to their countries. I think this political perspective is changing, and there's increasing criticism in some of the African countries of what China is doing.
Oh, that's fascinating. Let me get Hal from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us on Radio Times. And Hal, go ahead. You're on the air. Go ahead, Hal. All right. It's too bad. He was listening to the radio, and there is a little bit of a time delay. But his question was, populist parties' mischaracterization to call them far right, don't they often Oh, don't they also have left positions? Are there far, far left leftists in Europe?
Well, you have both of them.
Of course.
And some of them are so incongruous in terms of their programs that they actually draw from both far left and far right ideas and ideologies. So pretty much in every European country right now, you have, this mix of very populist and again, I mean, some of them we characterize as extreme right because they are very xenophobic. When it comes, for example, to social issues, they're not that conservative, for instance, right? So sure. it's a very uneasy mix of. But what brings them together is this hatred of the foreign, right?
It is this
idea that if their countries were to return to their original values, everything would be fixed, and the golden age will come back.
Their version of MAGA, I guess.
Exactly. So there is this desire to go back to the roots and the origins and to emphasize the identity in the face of this invasion. It's either goods or technology or people invading their country and essentially disrupting everything. Right? That I think is the core belief. Right?
Jude, it sounded like you want to weigh in on that.
Well, it's just so complicated. I mean, because you're right, where there is a collusion between the far left and the far right. But I think I think it's very important to ask them what they want. I think it's very important not to demonize them, because if you demonize them, then you validate them even more and legitimate them. And I think what's lacking with the established political system is that they don't reach out and include them in the discussions. What exactly do you want? How do you intend to finance this? What are your perspectives? And the far right and the far left have been anti. But what the center should do, what remains of the center, say, okay, how are we going to get there? Mm. Instead of the center and the right wing and the left wing parties co-opting some of these far right and far left wing so-called policies. I think this is very important that we have to listen much more, because there really is actually a crisis of the social market model and the crisis of capitalism in some ways because of the extraordinary impact of globalization.
Well, and I think we have very similar things happening in this country. I did an interview a couple of months ago with a man who wrote a book about Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, where a lot of working class people felt that the press looked down on them and no one asked them what they want and no one really cared about them. Maura?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that is something that needs to be addressed. I mean, the inequality that has been generated on both sides of the Atlantic has essentially meant that the model is not working for everyone. Mm-hmm. And it is true, the mainstream politicians and those who are doing well have essentially ignored for the last 20 or 30 years those who have fallen behind. And we need to listen to them. There's no question about that. And by the way, that goes for the established political parties as well. They essentially forgot about those who were being left behind.
Do you think, about 30 seconds, I mean, is there, do leaders understand this and are they willing to do it? Very quickly, Judy.
At the beginning, too, they've got to use digitization, social media, but at the end of the day, they've got to get out to the towns, the villages, the schools, the universities, the factories, get out there and be confident. This is what we are. Democracy is the best system available.
On that note, Judy Dempsey, as always, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Big pleasure.
And she's non-resident senior fellow at Carnegie Europe, editor-in-chief of Strategic Europe. Maura Guillen, as always, thank you for joining us
as well.
And he's from the Wharton School. He's got a book called Rude Awakening, Threats to the Global Liberal Order. Well, we have compiled a best of 2018 on Radio Times for our Facebook group. We want you to weigh in and tell us about the interviews that you love the best this year. Just put Radio Times listeners in the search bar. You can join the Facebook group and then you can comment on the thread. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us.